The main body of tonight's show, a little bit later on, I shall be talking live with Simon Spaniard of the White Rabbit Education Group. Some people will remember the initial conversation I had with Simon over a year ago on the Dr. Rock Show, talking about the time when he realised that as a mortgage broker and a retail banker, he was in fact using the wrong dictionary, and that rather than helping people out, he was accidentally turning them over. And after a couple of years of committed self-education, he converted his mortgage broking business into a claims business and set about taking the system on, as it were, with a fair degree of success, it has to be said. That particular conversation was rebroadcast, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, when I first started having a bit of difficulty getting to my studio to do the show. So it's been on quite recently. In our conversations today, we're going to be seeing what Simon's been at since then. I've met him a few times, and he's been very busy for the years in between, and has has come up with some definitely interesting ideas for pursuing his various cases further. So that'll be coming up a little bit later, probably sometime around 7:15, 7 o'clock. You're listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Hopefully I've got my special guest for the week, Simon Spaniard, with me. Can you hear me, Simon?
I can. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. How are you?
Yeah, very, very well. Very well.
Excellent stuff. Thanks for coming and joining us on TNS Radio again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And
Oh,
you.
that's nice.
You actually sent me something this morning which I thought was quite interesting. It was, I believe, an article from the BBC concerning a character who'd got a bit cheesed off with all of the PPI phone calls that he was getting, and decided that, a Spaniard style, he was going to try and at least make a few debt tokens out of this experience. Can you summarise what was going on for people?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's not someone I know of necessarily directly, but he certainly seemed to employ similar tactics. And reading through the article, chap had received some telemarketing sales calls, received them from one particular company. I think the calls originated in from an Indian call centre. He then spent a period of time getting transferred over to England and explained that, you know, he hadn't given them permission to phone him. He didn't want their phone calls, and if they phoned him again, he would charge them the princely sum of £10 per minute. No less than 2 days had passed before he then got another phone call, and he waited the 19 and a half minutes to get back transferred over to England. Went through to the very same company that he'd spoken to previously and that had previously promised to remove his number, and he then demanded that they remove his number again. However, this time he followed up with an invoice for his time at £10 per minute. 19 and a half minutes equals 195 quid. He then, I think, when they refused to pay the first time, he then sent them a chaser, and then he escalated to court proceedings. And as I understand it, they actually settled. I think it was settled outside of court, from the wording in the article. And the point that that guy's making, and the point that I've tried to make, is that, you know, if a company is taking up your time and you haven't agreed to, you know, donate that time to that particular organization, then why should you be left with, for example, in that guy's situation, why should you be left with two lengthy phone calls, people wasting your time? You don't want them to phone, you haven't invited them to phone. So why should you be left really having lost 30, 40 minutes of your life, having to remonstrate that these people shouldn't be phoning you and you don't want them to phone? And so what that guy was able to do is turn that situation around, whereupon he then got paid £195 for his time.
I wonder if he'll be picking that up as a technique with some of the other people he's trading with. Because I always remember that tale you tell about, what was it? I think it was Sky TV, wasn't it? And one of your acquaintances, £52 a month package or something. And you, what were you doing? You trying to find out from them what the package, what the cost was covering?
Yeah, that was myself actually. I was you know, going back a good few months now, I initially tried to make contact with Sky because I was just reviewing all the contracts that I had. Obviously, getting into this stuff, I don't necessarily want to have any contracts with any corporation, and so I've whittled a lot of them down. And in trying to find out what on earth I had with Sky, I wanted to simply go on and review the package. So I initially tried it through the online access. And you find this with many companies. They give you a kind of My Account section. Well, I went in there, and I'd obviously forgotten my password or my email address. I couldn't access the account. And so I emailed off to the customer services, the help desk, to say, look, I can't access that section of your website. I must have forgotten something. Can you just answer this question? Or can you reset my password? And they wrote back effectively saying, well, can you email us via the My Account section? And it's like, well, look, you know, this is just ridiculous. It's members of staff who either don't want to be there or are just not reading what they've got in front of them. And, of course, the byproduct of that is that we then get frustrated. We have to repeat the request, or we have to then waste our time. And in that particular example, I ended up getting involved in a number of phone calls I must have spoken to almost 15 people attempting to get a simple thing, which was a breakdown of the package.
Yeah.
A very simple thing. And this ended up going on for a few months. And I ended up demanding via email and then via notice via the mail a sum of, I think it was about 660 quid. By the time I'd actually got to the final demand, it was 660 quid.
And,
this is charging just, you know, £15 per letter or phone call, £35 for one of their errors. So if they don't do what they should have done, and I then point that out to them, you know, this is all basic staff training. And, you know, if I'm having to point this out, then I'm effectively doing the job of one of their management team, and I should get recompensed accordingly. So in sending out the demand for 660 quid, I finally got through and spoke to someone with some sense at the executive team. And in effect, whether the lady was downselling me, she was very nice, and I had a good old chat with her. And she basically said to me, look, I can approve 330 quid. That's the approval limit I've got. If you're happy to take that, you can take that now. If not, the legal team will have to approve it. And I thought, well, okay. On some of these things, you know, you just want to actually make the point, and 330 quid, as opposed to going through the whole same rigmarole and getting nothing, is quite a swing. So I accepted the 330. Now, the funny thing is that with Sky, I've since hit them again, because there are still issues that are developed from that initial chain of conversation, which has still not been resolved, another 10 months on. And in the meantime, I've had the landline rental waived for a year, so that was another £155, so that was nice. And I think I've had a second sum from them. I can't remember how much that was now. I think it was about 80 quid for some more issues. And I've just unearthed another major issue with Sky, and I don't know if anyone out there is listening, but when you phone Sky, you're not speaking to Sky, or at least you're not speaking to a Sky employee. You are speaking to one of a number of different companies that operate some kind of inbound call center. So in other words, Sky are outsourcing the actual manual labor facet of the business, which is to receive phone calls. But the important thing is that these companies are getting access to your data. And of course, as I've been explaining to Sky, I can't recall when I actually gave them any permission to pass my data, which is, as far as I'm concerned, my private property, out to third-party unknown companies. And in fact, Sky, during one phone call, actually claimed that they did not know the names of the companies that they were allowing to access my details. Which is rather concerning.
It's kind of bizarre, isn't it? When there's apparently supposed to be so much control over our data, they just appear to be passing it on willy nilly.
Well, absolutely. But the thing is, what I think we have to remember is that, and this is the kind of way I like to approach these things, you know, I'm not here to just try and generate funds out of these companies. That's not the intention. The intention is that I want these companies to operate properly, and what I don't want is that in the usual course of business, if indeed I'm dealing with a company that I'm actually happy with, what I don't want to have to do is that every basic function or every basic request, I don't expect to have to ask that 4, 5, 10 times over, because that is just, it's unacceptable. Even if we look at it from a very, very basic customer service point of view, that's just a poor show. And that's not what the company advertises. These companies, as we all know, advertise, you know, fantastic service, that they'll make you smile, that they'll make you happy, that, you know, that they want you as a loyal customer, that they want your business forever, and that they're going to, you know, look after you. And the reality is often quite different. And so where companies are very, very willing, it would appear, to jump on customers and charge them everything possible with a kind of zero tolerance approach, I see no reason why like for like shouldn't take place. And with the number of companies and people out there, if they decide to, you know, maybe try this, you'll soon realize the number of companies that are just not stepping up to the plate and providing a very kind of basic level of service.
Yeah, that's
yeah, they're all pretty much awful.
That's something that I thought about having come to one of your seminars. It's a point you made that this technique, as it were, for effectively charging for your time, it's just like any other kind of work, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you pointed out that your problem won't be finding people to exercise this technique upon. Your problem will be identifying the ones that are going to work best, because actually nearly everybody that is providing any service at all is only seeming to provide the service, really. It's a bit of a bluff, a blind, if you like, just for screwing money out of you.
Mm. Well, I mean, and even on a kind of more basic fundamental level, you know, with a lot of the things which we're actually buying an alleged service or paying for an alleged service, a lot of these things, certainly if it's, you know, if it's certain products, things like water, gas, electricity, these are things which we're entitled to anyway, free. And, you know, the infrastructure was already there. And with a lot of these companies, especially, say, your local council, when you actually get to the nooks and crannies of it, the majority of what we're paying is really just to self-fund and self-create that business operation. It's for no other reason than to administrate for administration's sake. And so people, generally speaking, are really, when you understand that kind of concept, are being charged through the nose. I mean, we know we're being charged through the nose in terms of the way the whole system is set up and what actually funds it and what actually underpins it all. So we know we're paying for things that really we shouldn't be paying for. And I appreciate within this kind of matrix and the way that everything's set up, this is the way that it is. So for many people, what we have to try and do is balance the scales and ensure that people are getting good value for their money. And if they're not, that they're able to then levy charges in exactly the same way the company would levy charges against the customer. And that's really just balancing the scales. And obviously a side issue of that is that when these things then crop up, it does tend to make them a hell of a lot more enjoyable, because you're earning on one level while you're learning and going through some kind of processes or learning about the company and learning about the regs they have to comply with. But by the same token, you're teaching them. So as far as I'm concerned, everyone that's actually operating in reality, i.e. all the men and women out there, whether they're working for the company or whether they're going through these processes or on the receiving end of some poor service, everyone is benefiting. They may not all realize it at that time, but they are.
And it is spreading the knowledge, isn't it, of just how inadequate, if you like, the terms and conditions are that these people are operating under, and how little they are actually told about what they need to know.
Well, true, absolutely true, especially in the area of banking and local government. That is, you know, never more true than that. But I think, moreover, I mean, I don't know if other people out there have recognised this, but, you know, there are some things which happen to me. And I just think to myself, you know, when I was working for a big company however many years ago, I would never have spoken to a customer in the way that I've been spoken to. You know, okay, we all get bolshy customers and sometimes, you know, people lose their rag. But there are things where even just the most basic polite question is generating an attitude in the member of staff which is way beyond what anyone would reasonably expect. And now, whether it's pressures that are on them, and I'm sure everyone's got their own pressures, and everyone's got their own pressures at home, and there are various people that are going to hate their jobs. So fair enough. But that whole kind of that whole taking, for want of a better word, pride in the job and doing a good job seems to have disappeared. So some of these people just don't even seem to want to even try and enjoy the job. Even the bit where they're acting with other people, you know, which I always found was one of the best bits of the job, to be perfectly honest, when I was in banking.
Yeah, it's kind of what the job's about, isn't it? If you're in the service industry, then actually providing a service rather than merely appearing to provide a service is what it's about.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the best part of the job, as I say, I used to find it talking to people. You know, I've met some great people as customers, and I've met some good friends that were customers. So, you know, I just don't understand the kind of mindset that a lot of these corporations appear to have their staff in. But on the flip side of the coin, from our perspective, with people, whether newly getting into this free man thing or deciding to look at the law and deciding to maybe make a stand and not just be trodden over again and again and again, these are very simple processes to begin with and to play with, because you can really kind of try to hone your skills on your letter writing, constructing your sentences. And, you know, on that point, I mean, I've found myself, we all go through a kind of journey, not only in terms of the way that we perceive things and in terms of the way that we look at given situations and then refer to the law and the words and everything else. But, you know, I found myself going through a journey in terms of the style of my letters and the style of my notices and the way in which I construct them, and then also in the way I approach them. And what I find myself doing now is really playing with the words and the language and really constructing those sentences in a way to try and, you know, spellbind, for want of a better word, spellbind the other party, so that you are not only showing them and getting them on side to understand how poorly you've been treated, but by the same token, you're reinforcing that with regulations, law, their duties, their responsibilities, so on and so forth. And without necessarily threatening, you're able to potentially put across that potential threat if they don't step up to the plate. And so that's where I'm kind of at the moment with my own stuff, you know, in my mind, what I'm trying to play with. But I still think it's a very valuable process to go through so that people can get, hopefully, some nice easy wins under their belt.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, because it means effectively that that you're in the, if you like, you're in the position of actually being able to start the action, as it were, and get your practice from that point of view, rather than waiting until somebody's offending you with a letter and using the techniques on you, because they are roughly kind of they're sort of swappable situations, aren't they? If you get the practice in the kind of conditions that you're talking about, you will be better able to respond to the fictional bits of paper that come through your door, should you want to respond to them.
Absolutely. It is just purely practice. And I appreciate, you know, I appreciate there are lots of people out there that, you know, throughout their jobs or whatever, they don't have to, you know, type up endless streams of letters, and they've not been used to constructing letters or writing, even in a kind of Matrix-esque business world type fashion. And so there are lots of people that, for whom, you know, writing letters or making telephone calls and engaging in that dialogue is a very big deal. And so, just as it would be as difficult for me to go and, you know, do some basic mechanics on a car, all right, so it might be difficult for people to engage in some of these processes. But so that's why you've got to practice. And, you know, what better way of practicing than when, you know, for want of a better word, you're the aggressor, but the aggressor for, you know, justifiable cause. But you're the aggressor, you're the one chasing up the funds, and you can drop out whenever you want, without any comeback. And quite often, I think, as you mentioned earlier, because you don't have to go looking for these things, they do tend to just come your way frequently, these issues. You then have to, you know, get to learn with experience what kind of claims are most likely to succeed and what are not worth proceeding with? In other words, is it worth taking a 40, 50 pound claim to court and maybe wasting a whole load of time going in and out of court mm-hmm. with whatever other concerns you may or may not have about going into a court just to get 50 quid and maybe some costs? You know, you might just, no, it's not necessarily worth it because I've got all these other potential claims here worth 200 or 300 quid, which are more than likely to go through without going to court. And so we've got to learn to disseminate as to which one are going to be worth our time and trouble pursuing and weigh that up against whether we're likely to get our money before going to court or whether we're going to have to go to court and try and force it. And wherever possible, you know, I'll freely admit, I don't want to go to court. There's a film called A Civil Action with John Travolta. Good film. And within it, one of the first lines he comes out with is that, you know, lawyers issue proceedings not because they want to go to court, but because they want to force a settlement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we mustn't lose, you know, sight of the goal. And if played correctly, if we play this game correctly, not only are we enforcing our rights, but it is going to be possible for people to actually generate a healthy top-up to whatever income or revenue stream they have coming to them. And it's not for reasons that you've gone looking for it. It's for reasons that people have actually, you know, aggressed against you in terms of taking up your time and energy.
Yeah, and of course the... I mean, the primary aim here is perhaps beyond the education, is seeking the excellence in the public service. And hopefully, I mean, the more people that do this, we should eventually start seeing a reaction in an improvement in service, because I'm not sure we are at the moment, are we?
Well, the thing which people have to remember about the court service is that, you know, there are massive conflicts of interest. It's a fraternity, as we all know, that's been given license to hold monopoly over the court service and the function of the courts. But there is a massive conflict because the judge and any kind of barrister that's in there, so even in just a civil case, let's say a bank credit card case, you know, the judge and the barrister, most likely for the other side, are members of the same club. So we have a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, my old mum's a mushroom kind of scenario there. On the criminal side, of course, the judge and the prosecution barrister are both representing the Crown. So we have another conflict of interest. And so we can't expect to get fair treatment in that kind of arena when you've got a tag team against you. And, of course, it's always very important, as we know from numerous TV programs, it's very important for barristers to keep up their winning streak and to look good. Hmm. So we have to then ask ourselves, you know, unless I'm very confident and unless I'm really on my game, I'm probably going to lose.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
Because, well, so you don't want to go to court, but you can use that threat of court as a lever.
Yeah, so you're trying to stay out of the place where they're rigging the game and keep it where you can use the terms and conditions as they stand.
Absolutely.
That business of I don't know, I'll call it politeness for want of a better word, but I think it might just be kind of, you know, the art of civilized communication works so much better than being outrightly stroppy.
No, absolutely, and I'll be the first one to you know, to confess that, you know, I can lose my rag at times. I'm used to, or certainly in past lives, I was used to managing, you know, numbers of staff of varying abilities and varying attitudes, and so I was kind of used to being able to be quite assertive, you know, with those staff or whether it be with customers as well from a debt collection point of view. And so I'm used to having those kind of conversations. It is always more productive if you can get someone on the end of the phone that's prepared to actually use one of my favorite sayings, use their ears and their mouth in the correct proportion, which is they listen twice as much as they speak, because that's their job. And so if you can get someone that understands the points that you're making, especially the points regarding what that particular company has done wrong and how it's damaged you, then quite frequently you'll find that you get some kind of resolution. And I've had some of my best resolutions from being able to talk to people and communicate it by phone. You know, The issue comes when we have to put it all in writing and they take a stance and you take a stance and then everybody's at loggerheads. That doesn't really achieve too much at all. So, you know, it is important to actually, I think, not be afraid of engaging in those conversations. Again, practice. It's really the only way of getting, I guess, confident at this. You just have to throw yourself in at the deep end if necessary. But I've found that the approach that you can use, I would certainly recommend that people take a look at the Mark Stevens videos on Google or YouTube. Okay, this is Mark Stevens. Mark with a C, Stevens with a V.
Okay.
Apart from the very useful information he's going to be educating you about, just note his questioning techniques. Just note the way that if you do your groundwork and your prep work in terms of finding out, you know, in terms of what the company's done wrong, why it's done it wrong, what they should have done, you can then use questions to encourage the member of staff you're speaking to actually come up with the answers that you're looking for. And because they're coming up with the answers, it actually sells it to them. They resonate with it. They feel it more. And therefore, it means more to them. They feel it. And by the end of a line of good questioning technique, you can actually have them offering you the monies or offering you the resolution because they feel exactly where you're coming from.
So part of that skill appears to be asking questions to which you already know the ideal answer.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that gives us a key to one of the second things I remember you emphasizing in the seminar I came to, which is the ability to be persistent. And that really the secret to that lies not only in your questioning technique, but also in your preparation, doesn't it?
Yeah, true. And also, you know, a typical scenario, and I've seen it many, many times. I've had members of staff try it with me many times. And the scenario is that you ask a question that they don't want to answer, so they ignore the question. Now, the simple way of dealing with that is to bring them back to the original question and raise it again. People may recall a famous scene with Jeremy Paxman and a politician in which Jeremy Paxman asked the same question. I think it was for 10 minutes nonstop. Because the politician wouldn't answer the question. Jeremy Paxman wanted a yes or no answer, and the politician, being a typical politician, had to spend a minute answering the question. But he didn't give a yes or no answer, so no one was any the wiser. And the point being that you just keep bringing them back, you keep bringing them back, you keep bringing them back, and you address the same question until such point in time as one of you leave the battlefield. Now, generally what will happen is that the member of staff, if they really don't want to answer that question, okay, or if they can't answer that question, they either have to admit they can't answer it, or generally what happens is they might blow their top, which gives you cause for further damages.
Yes.
Because you shouldn't be treated in that way.
And of course,
most companies, you know, this is what I like to use. I like to use their words against them. So quite often, one of the foundational moves that I will make is to go onto a company's website that I've had a falling out with, and I will find all those quotes, all those declarations about great service, we answer questions, we'll be open and honest, we're here to help, and I quote that back at them. Now, funnily enough, I mean, ultimately, I don't know whether you're ready to move on to it or not yet, Dr. Rock there, but this is ultimately what got me assaulted by a member of staff at Santander.
Yeah, okay, let's do the Santander, you know, thing first, because I say again and again to people, I am daily shocked, even after years of looking into this stuff now. But that's a real doozy, that one. You've got a mortgage with them, haven't you?
Yeah, so to tell the story, because people at home may well want to go and check this out if you're not already aware. But when I got into this stuff, well, what is now 5 years ago, I watched a lot of the Winston Shrout things, and Winston was saying, you know, look, you realize if you've got a mortgage, one of these death pledges, then you've got to understand that you have most likely given the mortgage company a power of attorney to do anything that they want to in your name. And, you know, he kind of nudge and a wink, they're using it. So for 3 years, going back 3 years, I decided to, when I felt quite a bit more confident about what I was talking about, I decided to contact Santander, or Red Satan, as I affectionately call them, And I decided to inquire whether or not, by signing the mortgage deed, I had invoked some kind of power of attorney. Now, the story that I was receiving back was an emphatic no. I spoke to many, many members of staff. I tended to phone up and maybe engage in a half an hour, 45-minute conversation once every couple of months.
And I was repeatedly told no. You keep a record of every call you make, don't you, and who you spoke to and how long it lasted for future reference?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Always important, keep a record. And where possible, record it. If you've got a loudspeaker at home on the home phone, I've found it doesn't work too well with mobiles, but if you've got a loudspeaker on the home phone, use a digital recorder or something like that and just record your calls, log it all, because what you're doing is you're building up a record. Okay, you're building up a record from which they are going to be hopefully dropping themselves in it, hopefully doing whatever you want them to do, but if not, then they're going to be dropping themselves in it and building up a history and an evidence trail, an audit trail of certain behaviours. So it's important to go the extra mile, because ultimately it is worth it, right? If you can get your mortgage wiped off and or payments reimbursed, then this is worth the effort, right? So do your foundational work, build your evidence base and record everything, write it up, etc. So to cut a long story short, for 3 years I'd been asking Santander staff, did I invoke this power of attorney? And for 3 years I've been told no. Until we finally arrive at a stage whereby I emailed off, tried another email. And of course my wording of emails and letters is getting better and better as months pass, so I think. And I got a response in December last year. And it was a letter signed by someone within the executive team enclosing the terms and conditions. Now, this was the first time I've seen these terms and conditions, okay, since taking out the mortgage in 2005. Huh. And the letter which accompanied these terms and conditions basically said, I've conducted a full investigation. Now, my query was about the terms and conditions, right?
Yeah.
So I've conducted a full investigation, and I can assure you there was no power of attorney attached to this mortgage. Well, I was a little bit disappointed, because in reading the terms and conditions, which is the first thing I did, it didn't take me long to come across section 28, 28.1 and 28.2 of the standard mortgage terms and conditions for Santander, dated 2005, which clearly states that not only had I invoked a power of attorney, but that power of attorney was irrevocable, that Santander could effectively execute any document in my name which they felt was required to make the account work. It had caveats in there about selling the property if necessary. But it also had some byproducts of that power of attorney, because the power of attorney, according to the terms and conditions, is required, so this is repeated, is required to make the account work. Now, this is an important thing, to make the account work. But it's also required to enable Santander to protect their rights and enforce their rights under the contract.
Yeah.
So looking at it from that perspective, I've got a letter saying that there is no power of attorney. So according to the terms and conditions, they can't enforce their rights, and the account cannot work. So, of course, as far as I'm concerned, I'm of the belief that I know full well what they've done with that power of attorney in terms of creating the initial instruments to fund the account which I used to buy the property. In other words, I lent the money to myself.
Yeah.
Okay. And for anyone at home that doesn't understand that, maybe I'll have time to explain it. But in effect, money doesn't exist. It only exists on a bank's computer system. And the bank, by pure virtue of being a member of the cartel of banks, have been given this license to effectively just keep a record on their computer systems of what is going on in the physical. Unfortunately, what these banks have done is they have now separated what is purely a record-keeping function, that's the digits on the computer screen, they've separated that function from the reality, and they're now claiming that the records that they, the digits that they keep a record of, and the, what goes on in the paper world or reality, that they merely keep a record of on computer, they're now claiming that that is a completely separate currency. And so they lend thin air, but they repossess real asset. That, yeah. Which is, as far as I'm concerned, high magic.
Yeah, and
Paul Daniels can't do that.
No, and as you said, this apparently this power of attorney enables them effectively to create commercial instruments in your name for which you're liable, secured against your house, and without your knowledge.
Absolutely, and this is the funny thing, because of course the implication is, and I have seen for some of our Irish brothers and sisters, I've seen some Irish mortgage deeds and mortgage contracts, and it was very scary, because as you've just said, the bank effectively, the way I read it, was that the bank had the ability to create instruments, so as I say, in your name, for which you're liable. It doesn't tell you how much these instruments are or what they are, but it makes very clear that even when the mortgage is paid off, these instruments can be held accountable against your property.
Wow.
Now, now, from a common sense point of view, we have a number of issues with that. I mean, I actually spoke to a Santander member of staff the other day, and I offered him the opportunity to give me a power of attorney in his name for me to do whatever I wanted to do. And he didn't want to do it, right?
Yeah, what a
funnily
surprise.
Enough, right? So funnily enough, he didn't want to do that. And it was quite a nice conversation we were having, but it made the point. And it made the point that who in their right mind would enter into a contract where, as of that point in time, when I've got this letter saying there isn't a power of attorney, but I've got terms and conditions saying that there is, who would want to enter into a contract where there may even possibly be a power of attorney, which might be used or could be used by the bank to do whatever they want?
And yet that clause is in presumably every single mortgage that they've manufactured since, what, eight, did you say 85?
Well, certainly Santander have been doing it. I took my mortgage out in 2005. I think it's been in a lot of contracts for a lot longer than that. And as I understand it, it's not just limited to Santander. You know, I've had the same situation where I've gone into just other banks just to ask the questions. You know, can I have a look at the terms and conditions before I apply for a mortgage? And quite remarkably, I've been told by NatWest, Lloyds Bank, HSBC, that no, you have to apply for the mortgage before you can see what you're applying for.
Surely that's not right.
That's not right. That doesn't meet the Financial Services Authority standard on treating customers fairly. That's TCF. Okay, so check that one out, people. And it doesn't meet the key commitments of service from financial institutions selling regulatory products or regulated products. Now, I know that the FSA is a private members club, all right? I know it represents the industry's interests. But again, you can still use their words against them. And as I've been saying repeatedly to Santander, please explain what you've done in my name. What is this term and condition for? Now, I've had the remarkable feedback from Santander Executive Office, whereupon I was told that nobody, no one within the company can explain that term and condition.
And yet it's necessary to make the account work.
It's necessary to sell the product. As I've pointed out, as an old qualified insurance broker, as a mortgage broker, I've pointed out that it is impossible for me to sell a mortgage product unless I can explain the key terms and conditions. Now, I would have thought a power of attorney giving someone the right and the ability to do anything in your name is pretty high up there on the levels of priority in terms of what terms and conditions you want to know about. All right?
Yeah.
But they say they can't even explain it. Now, in terms of asking this question, as I say, down at the local branch, because I had no joy with people by phone, I ended up getting assaulted from a member of staff who just could not cope with the question. Very simple question, but he couldn't cope with it. And he ended up losing his rag, and he ended up assaulting. Funnily enough, the CCTV footage which filmed that incident disappeared.
Really?
And there were only three cameras watching it. So, you know, it's begun to show, certainly in my own instance, it's begun to show really some pretty abysmal behaviour on the part of some members of staff who are affected by conflicts of interest in terms of protecting their teammates. But for anyone that's got a Santander mortgage, check out Santander's website. There's an actual policy about conflicts of interest. And it, you know, it states quite clearly that members of staff are supposed to declare any conflicts of interest that may exist if they're doing something for a customer. And they're bound to protect the customer's interests at all times.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how not answering a question, apart from breaking their own rules, demonstrating that they couldn't possibly have legally sold that mortgage because they can't explain it. Mm. And so I'm left with a mortgage that I don't even know what the terms are. I don't know what the terms are because I don't know how much I'm liable for. So, how can you have a product like that? Now, you know, it's ridiculous. You can't have a product like that. And that's just one issue which has been kind of identified with these mortgage products, even operating in their world, okay, because you can't possibly have a meeting of minds. What was my intention on that product? What was their intention? No one knows. So how can you have a contract?
Perhaps we can get onto it just briefly in a bit, the Bankster Busters approach to this. But I mean, which is to do with the Miscellaneous Provisions Act, isn't it, 1989, and the fact that the contracts aren't signed. This sounds every bit as widespread and deadly to the mortgage cause as that particular case. What do you reckon? I mean,
well, I've funny enough, I've got my mortgage sitting in that class action as well. Waiting to be argued, and I think that the Ombudsman and the FSA were, from what I last heard, actually in support of that argument and that class action. From what I last heard, I could be corrected, but from what I last heard, the issue with regards to the mortgage deed, and there's a few issues there. First and foremost, and this was pointed out to me by Michael over at Free the Planet, is that, and it's something that's so obvious for most people. Think about it. When you were buying your property, this is the process you probably went through. You know, you find your house, you go and check it out. You then need to arrange for a mortgage. You apply for a mortgage. Okay, they send you out the forms. You then get invited down to the conveyancer, and then you sign all the documents, including the mortgage deed. And then maybe there's a period of time, unless you're exchanging and completing everything all on the same day, there's generally a period of time between completion, right? Now, the thing is, the time when you actually signed the mortgage deed, or you correctly phrased, executed that mortgage deed,
yeah,
you were probably asked not to date it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I know it was standard practice as a mortgage broker. We never allowed customers to date any mortgage deeds. Whether that was a secured loan or second mortgage or whether that was a main mortgage, we never allowed them to date it. And it was just a process. It was just, as most people will come up against, it was just the way it's done, right?
Yeah.
So in the industry, we never dated mortgage deeds. Well, you need to check out, and I'm passing this information straight on, the Land Registry Act 2002, because if you didn't own the property the day that you actually signed it, that potentially invalidates that mortgage deed. It's not your fault, but it wasn't your property to assign or to gift by that deed. So let's say, you know, you go in and you see the solicitor, you execute it on the Monday, but you don't date it. The property completes on the Friday. Presumably someone then dates your mortgage deed. And I know that mortgage deeds used to get dated the day the deal was put onto the computer system at the bank. But the day you executed it wasn't that day.
And that's presumed.
Should be sufficient to invalidate that deed. Now, of course, if that deed is invalid,
have you gone, Simon? I think I've just lost you. Hold on a moment. Sorry about this, folks. I can't hear Simon anymore, so I'm assuming that you can't either. I'll see if we've lost the call. Hopefully, we've got the Skype up and working again. There was a distinct problem between me and the Spaniard there. Are you still there, Simon?
Yeah, I am. I'm here. Yep.
Excellent stuff. Sounds like we're up and running again. Well, we were about at the bit where you were talking about the execution of this particular mortgage deed and how you're dealing with it.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Go for it.
Yes. Yeah, so one other thing, just to recap. So bearing in mind, there are numerous issues with these mortgages, right? There are numerous angles that we can come at in terms of picking holes in what they've actually done or not done. And one of those areas being the mortgage deed. So forgive me if I already told part of this story, but whenever anyone's buying their property, we tend to go in and sign the mortgage deed part of the documentation at the solicitors or the conveyancers, and we generally do that maybe at a time when we're ready to exchange contracts, right? Now, apart from the fact that the mortgage deed is rarely, if ever, explained, and certainly I don't think anyone ever gets told about this power of attorney thing, or the creation of money from thin air, but...
apart from that, it's all open and above board.
yeah, absolutely. But the main thing is, we're signing a deed to execute something against the property when the property isn't actually ours on that day. And of course, we're then asked not to date that deed, because the mortgage company will date that the day that they set the account up on their computer systems. So that's an incorrectly executed deed from that perspective alone. And people should go check out, as I've been informed, and I trust the information, the Land Registry Act 2002, because it could well mean that you can liaise with the Land Registry and say, oh, I'm very, very sorry, I've mistakenly executed this document when I didn't even own the property. And so therefore kind of removing the ability of the mortgage company to have that charge over the place. But secondly, the implications are that if that mortgage deed was not executed properly, then of course the power of attorney and the mortgage company's rights to enforce their rights or to operate the account then just disappears out the window.
And what happens to all the instruments created under that power of attorney?
And all those instruments would be, you know, apart from the fact that from my point of view, it's debatable whether they're fraudulent or not anyway, but they would categorically have been issued without power of attorney. So they've definitely got to be fraudulent now, because that deed no longer exists. And I think even from an alternate perspective, so that's just on the perspective that the deed has been executed very innocently by probably most people in this country that are homeowners or think they're homeowners, those deeds have been executed incorrectly. Now, the second thing to bear in mind is that we know what it's like. You get bits of information as you're learning all this stuff, and you keep coming back to the same bits of information, and they suddenly mean more because your knowledge has improved, or you know, you're looking at things from different angles.
Yeah.
And there's a nice little video on YouTube by a chap called Rob Ryder. Yes, he is American.
Oh, we like Rob Ryder.
There's some validity to stuff over here. Yeah, sorry, Doctor.
That's all right. He's been on the show as well. He was on Dr. Rock talking about his investigations of Blackstone's Law. He's a very interesting man. It's Rob Ryder, isn't it? With two B's and a Y in the Ryder.
That's right. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
So I watched a nice little video from him recently put up where he'd actually looked at the mortgage deed. And obviously in the States, I think they have a number of different types of products and how that mortgage deed is used. But, you know, in essence, he was saying, look, if we're looking at it as a deed of trust, what's supposed to happen is that, you know, once we, the customer, have executed our bit, in other words, we've signed it, we've had it witnessed, but we don't date it, in order to effect a true execution and delivery of that document, the other side, whoever the beneficiary is, must also accept it by signing it, sealing it and having it witnessed. And of course that doesn't happen. Now, I spoke to Land Registry just regarding my own scenario a few days ago, and apart from the fact that for years they've been telling me they don't have a copy of the mortgage deed, this mortgage deed copy has now suddenly arrived, and they seem to have a copy on file now, which is rather strange, given that I've been phoning up about it, you know, fairly frequently over the last few years. So now this thing has suddenly materialized, but only as a scan on their screens. But the young lady I spoke to was able to tell me that there were no other signatures on the document.
which is
apart from mine. So it's not been executed the other end.
Okay.
Okay, so again, we've got grounds to actually say, well, hold on, this whole deed thing has not been executed properly. And I know that in America, this was found to be a common theme, that there was a problem with the deeds, they weren't being executed properly. And whether that's for reasons that the mortgage company cannot seal that document, because ultimately it's supposed to be holding it in trust for you.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't want it. They want to hold it in trust for somebody else. Yeah. You know, whether we've got issues around that scenario, or whether we've got issues that they can't sign and seal it because it's not a proper mortgage, it's not a proper advance, it is in fact a fraud. You know, it just puts a whole, or raises a whole host of questions. But the upshot is that these deeds do not appear to be getting executed correctly.
Is the business of not signing the deed more or less the main point of the Bankster Busters case?
Well, I think from that section, so from the Law of Property Act 1989, Section 2, I think what it was basically getting at is that, you know, you had to actually negotiate the terms and conditions of a fully binding mortgage, and a fully binding mortgage could only really be created by way of bilateral contract as opposed to mortgage deed.
Right.
As I understand it, because it's a deed, you know, whichever way you're looking at it, you're being induced into a contract. And I really liken this. I mean, I love all the kind of theology connotations that come from it, but I love relating this to a pact with the devil. And in my case, it is. It's Red Satan himself. Even the flame is the logo. So I've actually gotten into a pact with the devil. And if you check out in Google, pact with the devil, and see what it means. And it says, you know, that we would sell our souls or give up our souls in order to be given a whole host of a whole host of ridiculous favors from the devil, but that we could only get out of it on a technicality. Right? Yeah. And I just thought, well, that sounds beautiful, because this seems exactly what we are doing. We're getting out of these things, or looking to get out of these things, on technicalities. But they're pretty big technicalities. I mean, you know, when we're talking about what I would construe as being fraud or misrepresentation, we're talking big technicalities. And this kind of leads me on to maybe one or two ways that people can start making noises about their mortgage without necessarily taking it on full-blown.
Right, so a pleasant and friendly way of dealing with the problem.
A pleasant and friendly way of doing it, because I know, and certainly I've experienced, I can't guarantee this 100%, because we're always dealing with different people, different banks, different scenarios, different times of day and everything else. So there are variables there, okay? But this kind of thing has worked, all right? On its day, it worked. And that is really, from a very nice point of view, to start raising questions. In fact, I've even constructed a letter for the other half on an account, whereupon the approach was that, you know, I'm really concerned. I've been reading some stuff about this Freeman thing, and I'm really concerned. It's suggesting that, you know, you don't answer questions, and that you've created this money from thin air, and that you've tricked me and stuff. And I find it very hard to believe, because you've always been very nice with me.
Yeah.
So I'm just really seeking to have you at the bank put my mind at rest. And if I could just maybe ask you to answer these questions so that I can go back to those people on the internet and show them that they're wrong. Okay, you get my line of attack here?
Yeah, that's very good.
Right? So that you're coming in from a perspective of you don't believe it, and you just want reassurance. And of course, the action of the bank staff are probably going to force you into a situation where they prove that you can't believe them, but you should be believing the Freeman thing, because they're probably not going to answer questions. However, this all goes to an approach which, in asking questions about power of attorney, whether they had a duty to explain all the terms and conditions up front, whether they had a duty, in accordance with treating customers fairly under the FSA, to explain all these terms and conditions and to present the actual true nature of the contract in a clear and not misleading fashion.
They certainly have a duty to understand the damn thing themselves.
Absolutely. Otherwise, how can they sell it?
Yeah.
They can't, right? And that would breach their qualification, which is called CMAP, right? Big C, small e, MAP. Yeah. That qualification means that when I'm selling a regulated product, I've got to be able to explain it, all right? Otherwise, I can't sell it, yeah. Simple as. And so you've got the whole method by which it was sold for the usual reasons, you know, lack of equal consideration, i.e. they tricked you, they lent thin air. The presentation of the whole contract, they can't explain it. What's the power of attorney for? I have an absolute right to know what they've done in my name and what they're planning to do in my name.
And they have
we know that question alone reveals how they financed it. Yeah. Sorry.
And that they need to have a similar need to be able to explain it.
Well, absolutely, because it just defies logic as to, you know, I mean, my own situation, and this will be the situation for a lot of other people, what's your contract? Because I can't tell you what my contract is. I don't know what I'm liable for because I don't know what instruments they've created in my name with me as surety for that. So I cannot possibly even begin to explain what my liability is under that contract, and I can't even tell you what the contract is because I don't know. And the disturbing thing is they don't know either, so it would seem, or so they claim.
I mean, this really is quite outrageous, isn't it? Because what we're doing here is talking about what seems to be a whole new fatal flaw in mortgages amongst several others that we're already aware of.
Yep. And even in their world, I mean, you know, what we've got are a whole bunch of, if we look at it for what it is, we've got a whole bunch of financial institutions which are cutting corners in their own processes. They are staffed by a team of people that do not understand the product, do not understand the lawful requirements of those products, may well be facing difficulty trying to get answers themselves, but that doesn't negate their responsibility to answer our questions. And we've got companies which are, as we know, creating this money from thin air, so there's no risk on their part. They haven't spent anything more than it took to pay the member of staff to handle that application and the paperwork and then key it into the system. That's it. That is the entirety of their costs.
Yeah.
Okay, that's their risk. And yet we are being asked to promise to pay back with our sweat equity funds probably three times over what you borrow.
Yeah.
You probably pay it back three times.
Yeah.
And provide them with security in the form of the actual fee simple, the home itself. Okay, and agree that these companies can create commercial instruments in our name and sell them for their benefit. Now, most people would argue, and even consumer watchdogs would argue, that the interest rates are debatable. Well, where on earth do these companies get off basically saying, well, not only are you going to pay us back three times because of the length of period you've got the loan over, and here's an interest rate which people may or may not want to debate as being justified, but we're also going to going to create all these other instruments, sell them, and pocket the money. Thanks very much. You're very generous. Thanks, Simon. That's just not on. Now, all of this is being done under gift. We're gifting it all.
Just giving it all away.
We're giving it all away. It's the death pledge. Giving it all away.
At the same time, I mean, it strikes me talking to you now that it does make it a really good place for people to start for all sorts of reasons. I mean, firstly, because the contracts concerned, like apparently all the contracts we're dealing with, are obviously, demonstrably, and fundamentally flawed to the point where they can't be considered to be what they claim to be. Secondly, the results of that have been, I'm aware, in America, of people managing to get homes that have been repossessed, given back
yep.
to them. So you get your biggest your biggest nominal asset, shall we say, back in the process. And that in itself, the fact that it is such a big thing and the fact that it is basically a contractual problem could well end up opening lots of people's eyes to the nature of the other contracts they're dealing with. And because they're likely to, in the long run, I would hope there's likely to be some success on this, it would also improve people's confidence, wouldn't it, to go for a bit more perhaps?
Well, absolutely. If you're going to take out the biggest thing that you've got, you know, that's one hell of a victory. But I think we have to understand that the, you know, the approach that I'm going to come on and maybe explain or suggest, which is the one that I've followed more or less, it's really a nice soft handly approach, because once you start asking these questions, you've always got the chance that the mortgage company is going to become uncomfortable. And they're going to become uncomfortable with the line of questioning and where they believe it's going and where it's perhaps demonstrably going. And they may, and allegedly this has happened, they may just wipe off the balance. They might deal with you, right? They may not reimburse you completely, but they might try and do some kind of deal with you, which is favorable, okay? And you'd have to decide whether or not you go along with that. But the important thing is that, you know, when once you've raised these questions a couple of times and they're not answering the question, you have every right to now dispute the account. All right. So this is a kind of this is the method that I've maybe used. I've disputed this account because of my circumstances as they were and as they are. I've disputed that account. And I've stated, well, OK, look, according to your own words, this account can't work. You can't enforce it. If it can't work, it must be frozen. I want to know what you used this power of attorney for. In actual fact, my first question was, is there or isn't there a power of attorney? Because you're telling me yes and no at the same time, and it can't be both those answers. So which is it? And they don't want to answer this question. So I disputed it, sent in, you know, I've been writing in to them as well, and they wrote back with a letter of deadlock basically saying, look, take it to the ombudsman. Okay?
Take it to now, the ombudsman?
Well, we have to look at what's going on here, because the ombudsman, all right, what Santander are basically saying, by fobbing this off to the ombudsman, they're saying, well, Simon, we can't, or we're not prepared to answer that question directly, so we're going to fob you off to a third party, which is there to represent the industry and protect the industry, and it is. It's funded by the industry, so we're talking conflict of interests.
Yeah.
As I found out from one of their members of staff the other day, the maximum award they can give is 150 grand. Well, that doesn't meet my mortgage balance. So, and yet one of their underlying key principles is that they want to return customers to the state they were in before they took the offending contract. Well, how is that possible? Because they put a limit of £150,000 on there. That's not possible in terms of most mortgages in this country. So already the ombudsman are showing themselves to not even be able, not even be equipped to actually fulfill that which is one of their goals, one of their commitments, to return customers to the same state they were in before the contract took place.
And it means that your mortgage provider, effectively the extreme of the solution they can offer you, actually limits their liability somewhat.
Absolutely. By some strange coincidence, it limits their ability. And here we see the power of conflicts of interest at work. So, of course, what I did was I disputed the account, and they referred me to the ombudsman. And I said, well, that's great, because as far as I'm concerned, this is frozen now, and I'm not paying anymore. And I haven't paid it 7 months in arrear now.
And that's indisputable, isn't it? If something is in dispute, then you don't have to pay it until the dispute is sorted.
Absolutely correct. And some documents to back this up. You can Google this. There's an OFT, Office of Fair Trading Leaflet 664, and there's also the Unfair Terms in Consumer Contracts Regulations 1999.
That must be a doozy. Right. That must be a real cracker.
Well, there's also some case law which implies this, in as much as if a contract is in discussion, if you're in discussion about it, then, you know, the original contract goes on hold. Now, funny enough, synchronicity, I happened to open up a contract law book the other day and just see some case law about offering alternates. So applying to things like acceptance for value or offering alternates to settle contracts. And it also covered this little point off about when a contract is in discussion. So you're in discussion about it. Now, the typical kind of response you might get from the mortgage company is, well, they'll try and say it's not in dispute. Well, come on, if one party is disputing it, it is by pure definition in dispute. When it's in dispute, and bearing in mind the mortgage company have elected not to answer the question, they have instead referred you to a third party for the answer. Well, as Santander tried to say to me, they tried to close the file, the complaint file, their end, and then say, well, it's our policy because we've closed the complaint file. We've got to chase you for the money. So I said, great. If the complaint file is closed, you must have an answer. What did you use the power of attorney for? Well, we don't know. I said, well, there you go. Case isn't closed, is it?
No.
So by pure definition, if you can't give me the answer, the case isn't closed. Open that case up again. This account is in dispute. Now, it has been a bit of a battle. They've not been nasty in terms of debt recovery. They've listened to me, and I've probably educated them vastly more than they would want to be educated during those calls. But it does get frustrating, and those calls really shouldn't be taking place. They're not allowed. That's harassment. Harassment Act 1997.
To try and extract payment from you when the account is in dispute.
Yeah, well, what they're basically saying by their actions is they're saying, okay, well, there's a question mark over the validity of this contract. So we want you to fulfill your side of the contract, Simon, until such time as this is proven that it's an actual valid contract or not.
Yeah.
Well, by the same token, why don't they reimburse me everything? And if it proves to be a valid contract, I'll send it back to them. No, of course they don't want to do that. They want me to carry on fulfilling my one side of the contract whilst they do not fulfill their side. And part of their side of the contract is to answer questions and explain the terms and conditions. And they're not doing it. So they're in breach of contract as far as I'm concerned. And you see, what we actually have with these mortgage contracts, you know, the way that I perceive it is this. You know, we have a misrepresentation at the outset. We have a fraud in the inducement, so it's fraud by misrepresentation. They're inducing you into a contract which they should reasonably know to be fraudulent. They're not explaining the true nature of that contract. They're not risking anything in that contract because the money's made from thin air. Okay. So they're certainly not disclosing everything and fulfilling their obligations under the FSA, which is treating customers fairly, to explain all the terms and conditions and the implications. Even if there is a conflict of interest, they have to acknowledge that and protect your rights. And then they're not answering questions after the event.
And as you, your experience with them has been, as you say, they assaulted you. Apparently they claimed they could read your mind as well, didn't they?
Yeah, in phone calls with the executive office, I actually had a member of staff claim that I didn't need to tell him what an issue was because he could read my mind. So I challenged him to do it, and he couldn't do it. And so, of course, he then retracted that. And that phone call, because he actually asserted that twice. I asked him twice whether he meant that, and he said yes both times. Then I put him to the test, and he failed miserably. Now, funnily enough, the senior guy at the executive team at Santander listened to that call, and he claims the member of staff did nothing wrong.
Do they record their calls?
Yeah. Oh, they listened. The guy listened to it. He heard the call.
Right.
And he claims that a member of staff claiming to be able to read the mind of a customer and then falling very short is not doing anything wrong.
Well, I would have thought that there must be things in their articles of association that deny that. But I mean,
it's basic customer service. I mean, the guy's lying. It's a lie. And of course, you know, I've had numerous lies from Santander, both in writing and verbally. And so, as I say, the approach that I've taken is to really use their rule book against them. And now what I'm in the throes of doing is actually, because, I mean, this is the stage I'm at. And this is quite an interesting one because the ombudsman came back and confirmed that there was a power of attorney.
Right.
So he's now saying there is a power of attorney, and he's given me a definition, which differs from the terms and conditions definition. So I've now asked, well, great. Does your definition replace the original definition?
What's the difference between the definitions as a matter of interest? Is it easy to sum up?
Absolutely. In his definition, he put that the power of attorney is there to protect their security. That's it. Well, that's great. So I've asked him, well, what does the word protect mean and what does the word security mean? And does your new definition of the term and condition regarding the power of attorney replace the existing term and condition? Secondly, if a term and condition does exist, sorry, if the power of attorney does exist, why did Santander not just explain that day one? Or have they wasted my time?
Yeah. And why have they not explained it yet, for that matter?
Well, and the beautiful thing is that according to his new term and condition, they can't enforce their rights because that caveat's not been put in there. So the situation is that if the power of attorney does exist, and if that is the new definition, well, Santander now have to change all of their documents. They now have to be aware that that is the term and condition. I now need to understand what that term and condition means, so they have to explain it. If that term and condition, the new one, the new limited one, doesn't replace the old one, and the old one stands, brilliant. My question comes back. What did you use the power of attorney for? What have you done in my name?
Yeah. Yeah.
And secondly, why have these members of staff lied? You know, these people have signed this piece of paper to say they've conducted an investigation. Well, A, they clearly never read the terms and conditions, because I read them and very quickly found the power of attorney. Secondly, they've put it in writing that there is no power of attorney. Now, that's either complete incompetence or that's a willful lie. I don't know which one it is, but either way, it's not very good. And so we still have to come back to the very same question. What did you use this power of attorney for? What have you done in my name? You need to be able to explain it. So what is it? Now, they don't want to explain this, and we all know the reasons why, right? We're all fairly confident from other people's research as to what those reasons are and why. Because there would be uproar if the people of this country realized that not only were banks lending thin air and getting repaid with hard labor, so that's slavery, and in some cases, actual real asset repossessions, but that process had actually caused some people to even kill themselves because of the worry and concern about debt or this alleged debt. But then these bankers ingratiate themselves with huge bonuses and pay packets, and if even in their fictional little game it goes wrong, that loss is passed on to the people who are given the or sold the story that we've got to keep these private institutions afloat because otherwise there would be mayhem. Well, that's absolute rubbish as far as I'm concerned, because these banks are risking nothing, therefore they're losing nothing, and it is a cartel.
And what we have already is mayhem on that basis.
And what we have already, absolutely. We have absolute, complete and utter mayhem, fraud, misrepresentation all over the show. And of course, I know, and I'm perhaps preaching to the converted when I say that, you know, should we get dragged into that that court system, which is riddled with conflicts of interest. Of course, another conflict of interest is that Santander is going to be one of the biggest customers of Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunals Service. And which company is ever going to want to upset one of their biggest clients?
Massive conflict of interest, no.
Massive conflict of interest. This is not independent. And therefore, of course, we then see some of the ridiculous scenarios creeping in, which there are numerous examples among the Freeman community as such, that, you know, web judges just don't even want to listen. They just railroad because they don't even want to get into the discussion and be embarrassed. So they railroad these cases, they give the judgment, and they then put the burden on the customer whose challenge it is now to actually then challenge that decision. Because if you don't challenge the decision, even if it's blatantly wrong, that decision stands as good law.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you walk away from the battlefield, that now stands as good law. But the judge has just succeeded in reappropriating the burden of proof. He's just swapped it from being the plaintiff or the claimant's burden to the customer's burden. And he's actually forced the customer into a situation where their house is on the line, and that emotional threat is ever present behind them. So that's going to affect and jade your thought processes and the way that you approach things.
It strikes me that that's exactly the same way. I mean, that's a fair summary of what's going on in court all the time, isn't it? Is that the responsibility is being moved from one side to the other. And a lot of suffering and stress arises from that, making it very difficult to deal with that manufactured situation.
Absolutely. And so the way in which I've kind of coupled my approach with Santander is that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy for the account to be in dispute for as long as they want it to be in dispute for. Right. I mean, obviously, the longer I'm not paying. I just want an answer to the question. But if they want to dilly dally for 20 years, well, I'm more than happy to let it go 20 years.
Well, it's difficult.
It's a massive monkey off my back.
Is it not difficult to imagine how on earth they're going to come to any sort of resolution that could count as a sort of removal of the dispute, given the situation? It's hard to imagine what they could do.
Well, there's probably going to be nothing they can. Well, there's probably three ways this can go. Either one, they can satisfy me. Two, they can just leave it status quo. Or three, they can railroad me to a repossession. So there's obviously lots of variables in between that. And of course, what I've got to do, and the challenge for people out there, is that what we don't want to happen is to necessarily have the situation where we get railroaded into a repossession, and then we're having to sort it all out, having gone through the stress of being kicked out, moving home, finding somewhere. Yes, it doesn't kill us, but yes, it is a pain in the backside. It's an emotional upheaval. It could cause whatever stresses with the family, kids, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have to then go through the process of chasing that up and correcting that. And so knowing the way in which this could unfold, and knowing, i.e. the negative way, and knowing what I'm like, I have already made it clear to Santander that, and funny enough, the British Bankers Association and the OFT now, I've made it clear to these people that, well, okay, that this is the situation because you're backing me into a corner. And so whilst I can't fend off people with batons and things of that nature, what I can do is, if you don't want to actually resolve the issue concerning this particular account, why don't we get you to resolve the issue for all of your accounts? How would you like that? You can deal with one, or you can deal with all. In other words, I've filmed a number of presentations and interviews, and as I made it clear to Santander, the moment I receive the next arrears letter, the link for these presentations is going to go up onto the internet, and it's going to be emailed out to every single IFA, that's Independent Financial Advisor, mortgage advisor, mortgage representative body like the Council of Mortgage Lenders, British Bankers Association, AMI, AMI, FISA, FISA, the OFT, the FSA, the Ombudsman. And what I've done within these presentations is I've actually named the top boys from all these companies and all these organizations. And I've named them, and I've explained in the presentation that they have just emailed and that they have 30 days to answer these questions. And that if they don't answer these questions, then as far as I'm concerned, and if they're not prepared to swear this under penalty of perjury with unlimited liability, then they stand as co-conspirators to commit fraud against the British people, okay, by way of the banking scam.
Excellent.
And that they will stand as fraudsters.
You're serving a video notice on them.
Video notice. They've got 30 days. And I'm also inviting them to engage in what is actually going to be a very public court of record.
Brilliant. Now, the
impact of this is what I'm expecting, is that within that those presentations, IFAs and mortgage brokers are also being served notice that a record has been kept, that they've been notified. Now, if they sell any more mortgages, when they can't explain them, because the mortgage company, the mortgage lender itself, can't explain the term and condition to the mortgage broker, who in turn cannot explain it to the customer, well, then they have, by their very nature, missold a mortgage contract for which they are potentially liable. And we will hold the record on that.
Yeah.
So, in other words, Santander, as a specific instance, will then face, and they are facing this at the moment, this is the question they have sitting with them at the moment, they can attempt to enforce this against me, and I've got no doubt they would get their result in court. I've got no doubt about it at all. No matter how wrongly their mortgage product had been set up and sold. But the consequence of that is that they will not only have to deal with one, but they will have to deal with the many mortgage contracts that they have out there at the moment. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the way I look at this is that, you know, we as people over here, we have to. We're up against it. Okay, we're up against it. We've potentially got it all against us. I was certainly known for trying to overcome obstacles and having a knack for overcoming obstacles, and it's certainly not going to make me sit down and say die. All right, that's just not in my nature.
Quite the contrary,
and
I would imagine. Quite the contrary.
Well, you see, win, lose, or draw, I believe it's the mere act of actually showing these people that we know what you've done, right? And whilst we may not have the ability to overcome the huge force, violent force potentially, which is against us, we can sure as hell let you know that we know what you've done, all right? And we can sure as hell continue to attack that electrified fence, all right? Because sooner or later, with enough people doing it and enough people asking questions, everyone's going to wake up, and sooner or later, people are going to break through it. Well, it's certainly, and once some are broken through, more are going to follow.
It certainly does seem to me that, you know, even a couple of years ago, what we had was like small sections of broadly unassociated data. But it would appear to me that in this particular instance, in the instance of mortgages, where several of the unassociated bits are joining together to make quite a clear picture. Now, and the clearer it becomes, the harder it seems, just listening to what you're saying here tonight, the harder it's got to become for them to resist such pressure. Because, I mean, I know they've, I believe the Bankster Buster one, the representative action suggesting that all the mortgages are unlawful and illegal, has yep. got, I think, as far as about the highest court it can get to, which has said that it can't accept or a representative action, and that it expects these 3.5 million people to each present their own individual complaint. So I think it's being taken to independent arbitration now, isn't it?
I must admit, I don't know. I don't know what the next score is on that. But as a side consequence of this, which leads me quite neatly into the next bit I think you wanted to talk about, yeah. is that, you know, I've attempted fairly regularly and fairly intensively to get this matter taken up by the police. You know, I've related this into other credit, unsecured credit loans, credit cards and things of that nature, because, of course, what we've effectively got, you know, we have got fraud by misrepresentation. It is grossly benefiting these institutions and or certain parties within them. It's a confidence trick. It's a con man, right? This yeah. is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a confidence trick. It's just that the confidence trick is being perpetrated by someone with a fantastic accent, a great suit, and a lovely tie and shiny black shoes. That's the only difference.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
But it's a confidence trick. Now, I've attempted to get, you know, get the police involved for various issues, and the funny thing which comes back to me is this: even City of London Police, the police cannot take on board any financial crime, they were telling me, right, of this kind of nature, unless they've had the okay from a particular body. Guess who that body is?
Go on.
The Financial Ombudsman Service.
Sounds like a stitch up to me.
Well, it is a stitch up. We've got the conflict of interest we already know about. Santander pay, and I've asked them under Freedom of Information Act how much they pay, to the FSA. They will pay for their licenses, for their staff to be regulated to sell products. So they've got that contribution going to the FSA. Okay, and various parties at the FSA. They're then going to have a contribution to the Financial Ombudsman Service as well, which I think any consumer credit license holder undertaking certain levels of business has to do. All right, so we've got an industry, for one, as I call it, an industry arbitration court operating like an employment tribunal or operating like the DVLA tribunal. So it's an in-house tribunal service, the FOS. And they're making the decision, presumably without any kind of legal qualification in order to actually make legal determinations as to whether or not their members are committing crimes. But if they were to grass their members up, the members would probably go out of business, not pay the subscriptions to the ombudsman, and the people making the decision that a criminal offence had taken place would lose their jobs.
Yeah,
I think as a member of yeah. staff, I might just be wanting to pay my mortgage and look after my job rather than dobbing in someone in the banking industry.
But this is the other thing, isn't it? This is the other thing, is that so many people have got mortgages, including people in all of these bodies.
Exactly. And some of them have got preferable, you know, preferable rate deals. But a lot of these members of staff, even the guy at the ombudsman, didn't even understand that money is created from thin air.
No.
He didn't understand that. Now, funnily enough, when I spoke to one of the directors at the British Bankers Association, a lovely lady called Leslie, she knew that money was created from thin air. She understood fractional reserve lending. But when I explained it from the perspective of the Goldsmith's Tale, And I said, well, look, the moment that they issue a receipt for gold they don't have, we've got a misrepresentation going on. There's a fraud. She suddenly got it. Now, the thing is, of course, the lever that we've got is this. A, if these people that are claiming or painting the picture like the FSA that they're looking after the consumer when in actual fact they're protecting the industry, if these people don't act to stop this wrongdoing, then by their very action of non-action, they are acting to protect that wrongdoing. But if they don't even understand that a wrongdoing is taking place, does that not render them completely incompetent?
Or indeed innocent. Aren't they innocent if they don't know what they're doing?
Well, innocent if you don't know what you're doing in one respect. But if we're talking about, you know, we're talking about someone at, say, the British Bankers Association.
Mm.
Are they going to really seriously turn around and say, well, in actual fact, yeah, I never looked at it like that. I never looked at it from the point of view that the customer was handing over a security in the form of a credit card agreement or loan agreement or money market instrument, and that that instrument is cash, and that the bank was selling that, profiting the or taking the profits, and then making the customer pay back again. I didn't understand that. It's like, well, really? How much did you get paid last year? You know, how much were your bonuses? Sorry, who pays you your salary and bonuses? Oh, the bank industry. Not to know, it's their interests not to even ask questions. Right?
Yeah. I think you just broke up a bit there. Can you try that one again? I think you cleared up at the end. Oh, no, you're breaking up for me. I'll just have a look in the chat box. Can anybody out there let me know whether you can hear Simon? Because he's sounding a bit robotic to me.
Have you got me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Right, gotcha. Okay, I think that was my little thing pulling out of the computer there. But so what I was basically saying is that, you know, and albeit the fact that I recognise, you know, that a lot of people have been sold the line, even in senior positions, it's true. Even I, you know, and I wasn't that senior, but I didn't know any of this stuff. Because it never crossed my mind. I didn't have time to think about it. I was too busy hitting my targets.
It was many years for you. It was many years for you as well, wasn't it, of not knowing?
Well, absolutely. So I do understand that some of these people may not know. However, once it's brought to their attention, they have a duty to act, right? And certainly the FSA, as I understand it, which has been appointed, I think it was actually named in the Act of Parliament with the Financial Services Authority. Sorry, Financial Services Act. Well, that means they've been appointed. That means they're in a position of trust. So they're almost acting in a kind of capacity of public servants, but there's going to be a minister there responsible. And there's a very important principle which came across the other day. One of the research team came across this, which is called the Carl Toner Principle. That's C-A-R-L-T-O-N-A, the Carl Toner Principle, which basically holds accountable, this is common sense, holds accountable the minister for the actions of the officers.
Yep.
All right? So we all kind of knew that anyway, but that's the name of the principle, the Carl Toner Principle. So you might want to check that out, people. And so what we've got to, you know, what we've got to try and do is say to these guys and girls that are allegedly overlooking this thing, especially the OFT or the FSA, it's like, look, this is what's happening. And if you're telling me that you've never noticed this before whilst you're on your 160 grand salary per annum, I'm sorry, but you must be incompetent, because I've been able to notice this, and I know for a fact that you've had lots of other complaints about this very same thing. But secondly, okay, if they are aware of it, why haven't they acted? That must mean they're in on it.
Yeah.
So you build up some levers, and so I'm actively trying to use those levers, because ultimately all we have got as peaceful men and women is the light of truth. Okay, we've got our swords, all right, because we're peaceful, and all we can do is hold court and come up with a decision and put it out there for everyone else to look at. And when people look at that truth or look at the evasiveness of these companies, the truth should speak for itself. And that's all we can do. And so from Santander's point of view, where I'm coming from, it's a case of, well, look, I'm going to make this a very, very public matter. So you might cause me harm, but ultimately, knowing me, you'll have me on your case for 20 years. Because I've been on companies' cases for 10 years, 15 years in some instances. You know, I'm already like that. Not every day, but you go back to these things. And so ultimately, you know, if you're committed to actually getting a result or to seeing right done, then stand up with everybody else that's standing up, because together we make a louder voice. And even if they consider our paperwork to be comparable as an analogy to, say, like a bumblebee flying towards the windscreen of their car, yeah, one piece of paperwork they can easily dispense with. But when you get a swarm coming at you, even though you're in your car, the chances are you may well want to spin that baby around and go the other way. All right. And so the analogy being that the more of us who get up and win, lose or draw, stand up and show these people, just speak the truth, tell it as we know it. We know there are conflicts of interest in this court. I'm not going to get a fair trial here. We know there are conflicts of interest behind the scenes with you companies. We know that the staff have got a conflict of interest, because if they tell the truth, they lose their job. So I know that you're going to probably lie to me. But until you come out and prove X, Y, Z, I'm sorry. It's bullshit. And no matter whether you cause me harm or not, this is the case. And I know why you're not coming out to disprove it, because you can't.
And that's what makes this a special case, I think, because it's becoming so clear on the mortgages that there are things, as I said earlier, that are demonstrably wrong. That
yeah.
if we want a thing to make a justifiable noise about and start tying up the admin, then this is a bang to rights, this appears at least to be a bang to rights target. And also, the more people that are doing it, the safer it is for everybody.
Absolutely. And remember, anyone that says to people out there that, you know, hey, you're going to destroy the country, you've got to do like everybody else does. We all decided we want to pay the mortgage, you know, because we can't be bothered to go and investigate anything else. And therefore, because I've got to pay it, you've got to pay it. And I'm kind of harping back to that video on YouTube about the guy in the States that managed to do an adverse possession for $28 and his neighbors were kicking off because he'd read the law and they can't be bothered. So they felt he should pay a mortgage just like them.
That's a bit like, so look, you know, I'm just, you know, hey man, hey, I'm being beaten up over here, so you should be beaten up too.
Yeah, because the government's doing it, and that must be all right. So, you know, this is not going to destroy the economy unless those banks want it to. They created it from thin air, right? They've lost nothing apart from in their little intrinsic little game, in their little world in which they all want to just win, 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 win. They're not losing anything. There's only one way that credit crunch came about, and that's because the banks tightened up the ability to access our own credit entries. Yeah. And they didn't make stuff available to businesses and people in the forms of, you know, loans of credit. So we've got to understand that it is the banks that are putting a stranglehold on everything. I think that our politicians, putting it very, very politically correct, or in politically correct terms, our politicians need our help, because they've got a gun put to their heads by the banks. All right. And you know, we can refer to JFK, Abe Lincoln, and all the other quotes throughout the ages about the banking and what it would do. And so I think, you know, one way of approaching this, certainly with other people and the masses when speaking to them, is to say, well, look, the banks have got the politicians. They've got them banging to rights. They've got a gun to their head. They're forcing them into this situation. They need the people's help.
Yeah, another good
approach. And that's our lawful excuse to stand up and start battling these things.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be
openly.
It's going to be very interesting to hear that, where that goes with you, particularly as time goes by, because I'm sure you come back and talk to us about it. And obviously, there's a lot of other action in other fields on this as well. But I was with, and that I think is. Also, lots and lots of useful information there on how things actually stand. You must, just as a matter of interest, you must have a whole pile of paperwork that you're going to be able to charge Santander for.
Well, the funny thing is that they still insist they're charging me 40 quid a month. Although, again, as a standard for people, when a bank charges you something, ask for a bill. On average, these transactions that go through, the computer monitors everything. It's the computer which flags an account up. It costs the computer 51p per transaction on average. So if a computer is monitoring an account to bring it up onto report, it didn't cost that computer much at all, right? And so therefore, £40 is a false bill. Yeah. They'll never send you a bill because they'll be committing fraud the moment they do it. Though, yes, Santander are amassing a whole host of charges, although as far as I'm concerned, I want, as a satisfactory resolution to that, the entire balance wiped and all my payments reimbursed. Yeah. Now, I might allow them to keep something for their time and trouble, but that's the kind of negotiation I want to go down, or that's the avenue I want to go down. And in my own mind, if that does not come about, then as far as I'm concerned, I am going to lean each and every single member of staff that has touched that and decided not to investigate properly.
Right.
Okay, now I don't necessarily want to do that.
It's a lot of work.
But if I'm left no option, then I'm left no option. Mm. And my absolute goal is that if this is the avenue and the course they wish to pursue, then as far as I'm concerned, I shall not rest until each and every one of the homeowners in this country is fully aware of what they're in. Because from an alternate perspective, if the government were 100% behind this drive to reduce the nation's debt, why don't they just get banks and credit card companies and mortgage companies to actually explain how it really works? Because I'll wager that the majority of people would have probably turned their noses up and said, there is no way I'm allowing these guys to ingratiate themselves even further, okay, or have an open license to create money in my name, fund whatever, do whatever, pay themselves whatever, and then ultimately, when it all does crash, and the system, as we know, is designed to crash, because, you know, once this illusion of lending out electronic digits from thin air has come to its end, because people always say, well, I can still go and buy my food or buy my CDs or buy my beer or buy the this and that and the other. Yeah, you can at the moment. Absolutely correct. You can at the moment while the game of Monopoly is continuing. But when it's over, who's got the gold? Who's got the real asset? And who's got digits on a computer screen which they can't access, or that the electricity's gone off and they can't see anymore?
And they're just...
Well, that'll be us lot.
Yeah,
we're left with the intangible digits, and the bankers and their cohorts will be left with the real asset, the planet, all the gold, all the mineral, all the oil, all the everything, and we're left with nothing. And that is not what we intended, and it is out and out fraud, and it is all void as far as I'm concerned. It is completely void.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot to gain as a people. And we have a lot of wrongs to put right. I think they're very simply put right, but it certainly needs people to start voicing this among their peers and to the bank staff.
It is true, I think, to everybody. The money out of thin air conversation is one that I have quite often. And the response I most often get is something like, well, I'm not much of an economist, but I think you're making some sort of mistake there. It doesn't even seem to be known by quite a lot of the guys purporting to be economists and, you know, reporting on that very subject. It's quite mysterious, really. And it does make them look very weird when you know what we know, to be listening to people who don't know that, talking to the entire nation on the telly.
Yeah. Well, I've had the exact same experience myself with a professor of economics, and he went mental when I even suggested that money was created from thin air. You know, and of course, these people have built their entire lives. I mean, this guy might have had 30 years teaching this stuff, you know, and for me to come along and tell him that what he's teaching is a load of bollocks, you know, of course, I didn't say it in those words, but, you know, ultimately, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, of course, he's not going to take that very well, but his entire paradigm was, you know, came crashing on down.
Yeah, I was going to say, what must
the fact of the matter is... The fact of the matter is that, you know, this is in fact the way that it works. If we look at any contract in isolation, if a contract has got fraud involved, it's got fraud involved, it's void. It's not only us that are getting conned, it's the retailers that are getting conned as well, that hand over their goods. Yes, it works the way that it works at the moment. Yes, it does work. Yes, you can go down to Sainsbury's and buy your shopping using a debit card. Yes, I appreciate all of that. But what everyone has to remember is that at the end of the game, when the electricity is turned off and everyone's getting ready to go home, who's actually left with a home to go to? And who's left with everything else and all the gold and everything? This is a theft. There's a good book that people can access. It's by Sir Kenneth Jupp. He's a QC, an ex-High Court judge, and the book, strangely enough, is called Stealing Our Land.
Stealing Our
Land.
Was that Stealing Our Land?
Yes, Stealing Our Land. So, look at it. He's coming out about Stealing Our Land. He's talking about season courts, this, that, and the what he perceives to be a land grab. And it is. It is a land grab.
A land grab. Right. Do you want to check that? Do you want to check that little plug of yours again, Simon? You're breaking up a bit here.
Oh, right. Okay. I don't know. Does that sound better?
That sounds better. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So, you know, he's even alluding to what we all know, those of us that have actually bothered to read the information and not ignore the facts. You know, he's alluding to that which we know is going on. And it is perhaps the largest confidence trick, the largest theft, voluntary and theft by, you know, by deception. You know, we've handed it all to them. This is the beauty of it. We handed it to them. Yeah, they have.
Well, hopefully you're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. Sorry, we had a bit of trouble there. Everything fell apart around us. That was Motorhead, of course, and Sex and Death. And I've got Simon back on the line for the last few minutes of the show. Are you still there, Simon?
I am indeed. And a nice message there from the government.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's brilliant. Thanks for hanging. Hanging in there, Simon. I think we'll come back to the Santander thing when there's more to tell, which there most certainly will be, I'm sure, as time goes by. But I was also intrigued by your tales of going down to the local policy enforcement centre and reporting yourself for what was it, misrepresentation and fraud, when you were working as a bank employee. Is that what you did?
I did indeed, and it's something I have actually tried previously by phone with the City of London Police, and the guy that I spoke to didn't even want to comment about the alleged crime. But when I popped down to Radio Police Station, and funny enough, I'd had to pretty much lever the police into taking the statement about the assault at Santander, and I then followed it all up because I'd been given little hints during this 2-hour statement, and the guy was very nice, and he was getting it. He was understanding about, you know, Bank of England promissory notes, and he was explaining who he was doing business with, etc. And of course, I was dropping hints and encouraging him to maybe have a look at his terms and conditions, etc. But I then followed it up with the fact that I'd felt so, shall we say, disgusted with what had been going on and what I'd uncovered, that I felt that I, myself, in my ignorance, had unwittingly perpetrated fraud and misrepresentation, which I have. You know, there's no two ways about it. I have, against untold customers in a 20-year career in banking. And so I said to him, you know, look, at the end of the day, I need to at some point arrange to file in a statement, because I need to confess. I need to confess to what's been done. Now, the reason I've done this, the point of view or the perspective I'm coming from is this. Because I've been trying so kind of consistently to report banks for stolen credit agreements, so these are money market instruments, they're worth cash, they're valuable instruments, they're not being returned when loans are paid off, that's theft. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd put a gold watch in as a security for a loan, and then they decided to keep the gold watch, you'd be jumping up and down. So we should be jumping up and down about these valuable instruments, which are being used by banks for profit and gain. Without our consent, it's our property, and we have the absolute right to be returned a contract when we've fulfilled that contract. We should be able to tear up that promise. And so because of the failings I'd had in getting police to take this forward against the banks in a kind of open assault on the banks, I thought, well, OK, what's the only other way that we can perhaps attack that? It's got to be from within. So if we can't get members of staff, or perhaps, you know, this is still a working project, getting members of staff, and I would specifically focus in on the money laundering representative at your banks?
Yeah.
Okay, because now this is the beautiful thing I came across the other day, and this is why I decided to, you know, try and confess, because if I'm being found guilty of something, or if I'm being prosecuted for something, and I would have fun and games with that in court anyway, I wouldn't allow it to be an open and shut case, hopefully, but I want to emphasize the fact that if I could potentially be found guilty of that, so could all the other members of bank staff and mortgage brokers, right? So I wanted to get it kind of some kind of recognition in there. But if you're going to be attacking this from within the alternate way with your questions and so on and so forth, then I'm suggesting that you perhaps liaise with the money laundering officer for the company, because if the police refuse to take the statements or act on something, especially to do with handling the proceeds of crime. And this is crime. This is theft, right, of commercial instruments. They're selling these instruments and they're ingratiating themselves. So this is a crime, right?
Yeah.
Now, with a crime, on the one hand, it will be a criminal offence for us to go back and report this to the company or to go through the company's complaint process. Why? Because you're tipping them off. And not only does handling the proceeds of crime come into it, but so does the Terrorism Act.
Right.
This is a handy way of using the Terrorism Act, because what are these banks actually financing? Well, we know they are financing terrorism, right?
Yep.
So the thing is, if the police actually try to say, well, okay, look, you've got to go back to the bank in order to issue your complaint, the answer or the response to that should be, well, I can't, because you'd be forcing me to commit a crime by tipping them off.
That's exactly what the police told us to do when we went in to talk to them about the fact that we'd been burgled by the bailiffs, was they said that we needed to sort it out with the burglars.
Exactly, and you can't, right? That's tipping them off about handling the proceeds of crime. I believe the Terrorism Act actually forbids us from doing that.
Brilliant. Right? I like that a lot.
Right? Okay, yes, so do I. But if you're going to take it into the bank, then who better to take it to than the money laundering officer? Because we can then explain, and I'm trying to, I think I'll get it out on email at some point where I actually got this. I've got it all cut and pasted. But I think it was in the OFT guidelines. So where the OFT regulate, you know, people that have got consumer credit licenses, all the banks have to have consumer credit licenses. Check out on their website, and I think it was in there that I found this reference to not tipping off.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go back to the bank, though, who better than to use than the money laundering officer? And this is where we are from the analogy of Independence Day, planting that virus within the company. We are then setting off the money laundering officer, or the anti-money laundering officer, against his colleagues, because he's now going to have to investigate his colleagues, and he's going to have to do that without tipping them off. Otherwise, he falls foul of the terrorism bill and the handling crimes proceeds of crime. For tipping off, the exact same reason. So you're putting him in a position, all right? So I'm looking at ways of actually creating leverage, and hence that was the reason behind my going in to confess, which is something I'm going to try again, perhaps with a little bit more assertiveness, and you know, using perhaps misconduct in public office if they fail to act.
Yeah.
We'll get that recorded for entertainment value. Yeah.
Who did you speak to, as a matter of interest, when you who was it? Was it the first person that came in? Was it a proper policeman or a?
When I did it this time, I was actually in giving a statement. Yeah, I was making a statement out for the assault on Santander, and I kept hinting throughout that statement, and then managed to then turn that into a nice chat at the end, whereupon I expressed my will to confess.
Oh, brilliant. Right.
And I was told categorically, this is what I was told, because I didn't intend to do it, I was innocent. Yeah. As you say, I was innocent. He said there was nothing he could do.
Yeah, didn't have the intent.
That's great, because it does make great viewing as and when I film this next. So, because of course there you are confessing to committing fraud against numerous customers, and of course you're being told, well, you know, we're not going to investigate anything else, but you're innocent. Don't worry about it.
Wicked.
Make good TV.
Talking of good TV, are we going to get to see the video you've made for all the mortgage institutions and stuff at some point?
Well, as I say, that is a waiting, albeit the fact that I've spoken about it on this conversation. The actual video which I'm going to be encouraging people to send off the links to their own mortgage companies or to their mortgage brokers or to people that they know, because I'm hoping to to have this a nice clear cut presentation. So I've already shot one with Ben Lowry, and I want to shoot some more clearer ones, because I want this for people to be able to refer to this and say, well, okay, if it comes out as well as I hope, you know, here's the explanation, here's the citations of the law, here's looking at it from every law perspective within every law form. You can see it's not right. Here's what's been going on in America. Here's what's been going on in Iceland. Now, here's what your rules are according to the FSA. Here's what your rules are according to the OFT. Here are the rules on terrorism. Here are the rules on handling the proceeds of crime. Here's the Theft Act and how it relates to securities. This is what usufruct means. Now, what are you going to do about it?
Brilliant. Absolutely, absolutely peachy idea.
Absolutely. And the point being that it then becomes a very public battle. And, you know, I mean, I don't know where it will lead. Maybe it will lead nowhere. But from my own perspective, in terms of, you know, knowing full well what we know that in the courts, it may well just be at best a delay game. And some people have played that game very, very well. But, you know, ultimately, just my nature, it's in my nature to go very, very public with it and to bring everything into it, you know, and raise issue about the whole lot. But it is really, really important. Because in thinking, you know, in going through this process, and, you know, I've mentioned before, you go round and round and round the law forms and you study, and it's as if you're going up a spiral and you get revelations each time you come round and even approach stuff or read stuff that you've read before. You take a different angle on. You know, something John Harris said in one of his talks, which was about the consumerism and how the power actually lay with us, and it does. Because ultimately, the positive thing that everybody can do, if they don't want to necessarily engage in full-blown court battles, or if they don't want to even just ask questions, what you can do is vote with your money. Now, remember, if these institutions are doing wrong, we know that withdrawing cash from an institution can effectively put it under a lot of pressure. It could collapse it, because only 3% of their deposits are held in the form of cash.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on one level, do what our granddads and grandmothers told us to do. You keep your cash at home. Don't put it in the bank. Don't let them fractionalize off the back of it. Don't let them have the use of those notes, right? Don't let them trim down contracts that you've got with companies that you don't really need. You know, why are you paying them? Check out some of these charities. Your money's not going where you think it's going. No. Give the money direct if you can, or do something direct if you can. But don't hand these things over to these companies. If you do, make sure that you express your terms and conditions when you get into business with these people. And they can be very vague. In fact, if anyone wants to email me at whiteratteducation@gmail.com, I'll email out standard terms and conditions that I'm using now. They're very, very standard in terms of, I expect you to answer questions honestly. I expect you to pay me £35 for every error you make. I expect you to pay me £15 for every letter that I send if it's an unnecessary letter. You know, you can be very, very vague about this and just really cover points which a company is going to find very difficult not to accept.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise it's saying up front that you can expect to be treated like crap. Now, why would you want to deal with them? Don't even go there. It's just going to be a headache. You should also be removing any rights of any rights of usufruct. That's their ability to make profit and gain on your property, right?
Yeah.
And you should also be removing any power of attorney, all right? Because most companies, because they're going to administer these accounts for you on their computer systems, they are automatically operating with some kind of power of attorney. But what they're doing with that power of attorney is they are misappropriating the accounting entries called documentary intangibles, and those documentary records belong to you. They belong to your account. And for every debit, there's a credit, which means that your account will always be at zero. Always. If those entries are correctly applied solely to your account.
Yeah.
But they don't solely apply them to your account. They move them about in a series of transactions, leaving you with the debit or the debt and leaving them with the credit.
All invisible to us.
All invisible to us, because we can't see it. It's on their books.
Yeah.
Okay. And they then withhold that information. So they've got the power, they've got the information, and of course the courts won't force them to impart that information. So, you know, it's good old fashioned cooking the books, right? Very, very simple. Except it's made to look complicated by lots of fancy words, governing bodies, suits and ties, lovely accents, smart shoes, posh haircuts, beautiful buildings. Yeah, all this kind of stuff is just disguising the fact that it's a good old-fashioned confidence trick involving accounting fraud.
Yeah. I heard recently that that putting a box around your signature meant that they could no longer monetize the document because it effectively disappears the signature. Is that a...
Well, a lot of consumer credit agreements, and I have seen a lot of them in my time, actually have your signature in a box anyway. Now, the implication there, if we're looking at the boxing rule of admiralty, and we're looking at the fact that, okay, well, it's in a box, it's almost, it's on its own separate page. Well, what's on the rest of the page? You see, the implication is that if I give something to you, you can do whatever you want with it, right? So if I give you a vase, you could bin it. You could actually put it on your mantelpiece and put some flowers in it. You might decide to make it into something different, maybe make it into a lantern. But the fact that I gave it to you implies that you can do whatever you want with it. So what are these companies doing when they assume, for their own benefit, that you've given them your signature? They're going to use it for whatever they want to use it for. And so you have to express limitations around those signatures when you hand them over. So application forms, cross out the word application, put at the top special reposit. Okay? You know, express the fact that at the end of the contract, this is within your terms and conditions, at the end of any contract, you expect to receive the return of all original wet inked documents. They can keep photocopies, but they can't keep the originals.
Yeah. I'll tell you
what.
And
if a company doesn't agree to this, don't do business with them. Remove your energy from these companies. We the people could soon and very, very quickly, if en masse this was done, and maybe not even en masse, it maybe doesn't even need to be, but we could very quickly gain power, our purchasing power, our energy power, by removing it and withholding it and taking funds out of that system.
I think that's excellent advice myself. I haven't, I personally haven't been running a bank account for 15 years, which has not been easy, but it was a tremendous relief to get out from under. In fact, these last few words and recommendations, I think, have been really sound because it does enable individuals to do just small things that are going to make a difference. But I know we're trespassing on Freeman Jack's time now. We're sort of we're running a bit over, which is cool because we've checked it out with Freeman Jack. He's not going to set the dogs on us, so there's no worry there. But I know you've got some events coming up, haven't you, around the country? And it might be good if you could let people know what they are, because I personally I'd recommend a day out with Simon. When I go to workshop days and stuff over the weekend, I'm generally pretty dozy from about 2 o'clock onwards, but you generally genuinely kept me alert as a skinless eye for the whole day. It was absolutely brilliant. So what you got for him, Simon?
That's very kind of you, mate. Well, anyone, to be honest, anyone wanting to know the events, there's quite a few events going on and they're being put on by lots of different brethren. So I'm really pleased to see lots more people getting the confidence. No matter whether you've done this before or not, getting the confidence to throw little seminars in their local areas in order to educate their peers, right? Absolutely brilliant. There are some people that have taken it, obviously, to greater depths and have really learnt their stuff and have maybe specialised in one or two areas. We've got Vince, for example, who I think is on this station. I think he is. He is with the No State Project. There are one or two others. And if you want a list of those events, just email me at whiterabbiteducation@gmail.com and I'll ping back a list of events. But one thing I just wanted to promote, if that's all right, just to be a bit naughty, is the White Rabbit Trust YouTube channel. Now, I try to mix a bit of comedy with some cool music, hopefully, although I did pick most of it, so I don't know how cool that's going to be. But then mix that in with, you know, law seminars, videos online that I like the look of, and perhaps films or programs with messages in. So it's to actually get that address, it's so www.youtube.com/user/WhiteRabbitTrust. Okay.
Okay.
And what I'm hoping to actually start uploading are short presentations. I'm going to go right back to the beginning with this. In other words, I'm going to attempt to cater for people that are waking up. And what I'm going to attempt to do is cover the very, very basics with proof, with reference points, things of like the words of the person, you know, other words and things like of this nature, and actually come forward, hopefully, with clear, concise explanations, nice and short, so that people can watch, you know, maybe 5 or 10 of these things in a lunch break and not miss their place. And so, you know, if people are able to direct their friends as and when these videos get uploaded, I'm expecting the first batch of maybe 5 to go up this weekend, and I'll hopefully be adding to that at a fair rate each week.
Excellent. Well, that's a pretty exciting project. I shall certainly be keeping an eye out for those myself. And it's really great, isn't it, to try and get a kind of like, try and make the stuff, what we know, the best stuff we know, as punchy as possible so that people have heard it before they even notice.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, the more people that do this, flood the internet, you know, flood it. As long as it's clear and concise, flood it. You know, just get the word out, because now more than ever, all right, we need to build up to that crescendo where the you know, where the snowball effect really takes a hold. Because when we're looking at these people that are perpetrating their crimes, and we're looking at them through eyes which looks at them as if to say, you know, A, how can you do it, and B, you're committing a crime, come on.
Yeah.
Sooner or later these people are going to be embarrassed to do these jobs.
Yeah. Well, I think that's been a really excellent chat, Simon. Thank you very much for that. And
no problem, my pleasure. Yeah,
always welcome on the show, and we'll obviously keep in touch a bit. Thanks very much to TNS Radio, as ever, for giving the space to me and Simon to come on and shoot the breeze, and to ScottishSovereignsOnTheLand.ning.com for encouraging me to do it and supporting me throughout. And thanks again to you, Simon, for being on with me. I've got one more tune that I'll play. Like I say, come back whenever you like. Coming up next for all of you people is the fantastic Freeman Jack.